The American West has always been fertile ground for writers. Now Philip Meyer steps into that territory with his new novel, The Sun. It's a family saga that traces the settling of Texas from its days as a wild frontier to the oil boom. And there's no shortage of violence in this version of the story. Even the victims have blood on their hands, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Philip Meyer first drew attention a few years ago with his debut novel, American Rust. Set in a dying steel town in Pennsylvania, Meyer says he wanted to explore the decline of the middle class in the industrial Northeast. He set his sights on a different direction for The Sun.
With The Sun, I wanted to do something not quite the opposite, but certainly different. I wanted to think about our creation myth. You know, what is the fundamental story that defines America? And it certainly is the West.
To research the novel, Meyer read more than 250 books on the West. But that wasn't enough for him. To get a sense of what life might have been like for the Comanche, who play a central role in the book, he spent months in the desert and the plains, eating and sleeping outdoors.
I told myself to bow hunt. I took weeks or months of tracking classes on how to track animals and how to understand how Native Americans related to their environment. I went to a buffalo rancher who raises organic grass-fed buffalo for restaurants, and I helped him kill several buffalo. And after we shot these animals, basically, I took a coffee mug and filled it with the blood from the animal's neck and drank it, because that was another thing the Comanches did with some regularity.
The Sun is an epic tale told through several generations of the McCullough family, beginning with Eli McCullough, the first male child born in the Republic of Texas. At the age of 13, Eli is kidnapped by the Comanche, who kill his mother and his siblings. He lives with the Comanche for years, becoming a respected member of the tribe. But later in his life, he hunts them down as a Texas Ranger. He becomes a wealthy cattle rancher, and eventually his land brings more wealth to his family in the form of oil. Throughout it all, if something gets in his way, Eli removes it, with force if necessary.
Eli McCullough represents the sort of mythological heroes that founded America or founded the West. I mean, they're physically powerful. In this case, he's a small man, but he's physically powerful. They're physically brave. They take what they want. If you were to do some moral analysis of their character, you know, they wouldn't maybe, by today's moral standards, come out looking very good.
We hear one version of the McCullough family story through Eli's own words, but we get a different perspective from his son Peter, who sees his father with clear eyes. Peter's sympathies lie with the Mexican family whose massacre leads to more land for the McCulloughs, and that makes Peter a pariah in his own family. Finally, we hear what seem to be the dying thoughts of Jeannie, Eli's great-granddaughter, who oversees the family's oil business. Jeannie always saw Eli as a heroic figure and was determined to protect his legacy.
What should she tell her grandchildren? There were too many facts, and you could arrange them in any order you wanted. Eli McCullough had killed Indians. Eli McCullough had killed whites. He had killed, period. It depended on whether you saw things through his eyes or the eyes of his victim as he pulled the trigger. Dead people did not have voices, and this made them irrelevant.
But Meyer doesn't paint a black and white picture of the West. If Eli McCullough kills to get what he needs, so does everyone else.
There was an enormous amount of violence perpetuated by all sides. You know, the sort of guilt or horror is very evenly shared. And I think when you grew up watching John Wayne movies, which many of us did, you don't see that. You forget that. You sort of think of the Anglo folks, you know, the cowboys, as the sort of innocents in the middle of a great wilderness out of which ride these Native Americans, who we hadn't thought of as Indians, and attack, you know, the innocent settlers. And this, to me, was crucial to sort of attempt to upend that myth.
And yet, at the same time, you certainly are not presenting a sort of PC picture of life among the Comanches. This was really brutal, and the violence is depicted very graphically.
This is a warrior culture. You know, I mean, they were absolutely warriors. They did not show mercy to the people they vanquished. Torture was something they did, but just torture was something that Europeans engaged in ritualistically also.
Meyer says he doesn't expect that everyone will like his version of how the West was won.
I do wonder if there are parts of this book that are going to make people on both sides of the debate angry. the people who want to see, you know, the sort of historic Texans and the frontiers people as noble sort of innocents, and the people who want to see the Native Americans in that same very simplistic way. But to do this is to reduce these people to caricatures. So if it makes people uncomfortable, I guess I'm fine with it.
No one emerges an innocent in this story, not the Anglos, nor the Mexicans, nor the Native Americans. Each group in its own time fought viciously to get or keep the land. Eli McCullough emerged a winner, but the actions he took and the secrets his family kept will catch up with them in the end. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
The Gateway Arch, overlooking the Mississippi River from the St. Louis side, is one of the signature symbols of America, a great steel spiraling opening to the American West. It can be a marvel to stand below and behold it against the sky. But the Gateway Arch took almost a generation to build, and it hasn't transformed the city as hoped in the four decades that have followed. The story of a great American symbol is told in Tracy Campbell's new book, The Gateway Arch. Tracy Campbell, who's history professor and co-director of the Wendell Ford Public Policy Research Center at the University of Kentucky, joins us from Lexington, Kentucky. Professor Campbell, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
I was interested to read that kind of the first vision of an arch to mark the Louisiana Purchase and the gateway to the West can go back to a high school student named Geneva Abbott.
Geneva Abbott was a high school student in St. Louis in 1933 and was asked to think, what should the future St. Louis look like? And she drew this gleaming parabolic arch parallel to the Mississippi River.
And how did Eero Saarinen, an architect then working in Detroit, hit upon this idea of the arch?
Well, he entered the competition with over 170 other designers. If you could win this competition, it would be about $40,000 for the first prize, which in the 1940s was a tremendous amount of money, and it was the most prestigious architectural competition in the world at the time. And he came up with the idea of building a freestanding arch. At first, he thought it might be made of concrete. Eventually, he came up with the idea of stainless steel. It was originally four-sided, but a sculptor who had worked with Rodin convinced him that it ought to be three-sided. So over time, it became a much more beautiful work of art. And right after the competition in which Eero Saarinen won, Adalberto Libera threatened to sue him. And Libera was an Italian architect who said that this was actually a fascist symbol that he had designed for the 1942 Rome Exposition. And there was a great deal of controversy in the weeks surrounding the competition. In fact, would Saarinen's arch be shelved because it was stolen? Saarinen, of course, denied it and said that how can anyone really claim credit for what has been around for thousands of years? It's universal in so many ways.
Mm. What kind of clout was necessary to get the arch built?
Well, I think to see any great building, whether it's a monument, a cathedral, a skyscraper, it requires money, it requires power. And the arch is no different. It required political power. It also required a lot of economic power. And most of that came from a $30 million bond project. And you have to put $30 million in context in the 1930s, because that's about the cost that it took to build the Pentagon, for example. Mount Rushmore barely cost $1 million, so you can see why a lot of people in Congress were outraged over this huge expenditure of funds for the St. Louis Riverfront.
The point of that being it was supposed to be an American monument to mark the opening of the American West, right? So it was always envisioned as a national monument.
Well, the planners of St. Louis were trying everything to get WPA money into St. Louis. It was only after they came up with the idea of making it a presidential monument in some way were they able to get Roosevelt and the higher echelons of the New Deal to sign on to it. So the notion of making it a monument to Jefferson and westward expansion, the Louisiana Purchase, whatever you want to call it, was really an afterthought.
How did it affect St. Louis's large and quite well-known nationally African-American community?
Well, you have to keep in mind that one of the bloodiest race riots in the history of the country occurred really just a stone's throw from the Gateway Arch across the river in East St. Louis. And that racial history, I think, is crucial to understanding the arch. It's kind of invisible when you go there now. But you have to ask, who are the winners, who are the losers behind any great building? Because people are usually going to be moved out. And African-Americans, a bohemian bloc, mostly artists and painters, they lost.
The whole idea, of course, was that it was supposed to have some kind of transformative effect on St. Louis and renew and enrich it. And ultimately, if you had to move people around, the end result would be greater. How has that turned out over the past four decades?
Well, I think the results are mixed. On one hand, the Gateway Arch is a tremendous success. It has brought millions of tourists to St. Louis and has become a beloved national symbol. On the other hand, what we're learning is that those neighborhoods that were decimated in order to build the Gateway Arch are the kinds of things now cities are turning to, where people can live and work and walk. And what I said in the book is that this isn't really a monument to westward expansion as much as it is to the American empire of the mid-20th century that had the money, the resources, and the capability to build audacious architectural landmarks. We simply don't have the resources today to do something like that. It would be unthinkable to level 40 square blocks of a major American city to build a non-utilitarian structure in it today. And that's why I think if it survives for hundreds and hundreds of years, that's probably what archaeologists and historians will think then, that this is really a monument to the 20th century and to the height of American power. It was conceived after we won World War II. It was built while we were trying to put a man on the moon. And that cultural marker, I think, is there standing strong on the banks of the Mississippi today.
Tracy Campbell, professor of history at the University of Kentucky and author of the new book, The Gateway Arch. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
In the 1960s, the women who populated television were cute, a little silly, and they were married, firmly rooted in their domestic lives. But if many of those ladies were supernatural, Mary Richards, single, sassy, and filled with joy, was magic.
Who can turn the world on with her smile? Who can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile?
The beloved Mary Tyler Moore Show went on the air in 1970, and now, more than 35 years after it ended, it is still a source of inspiration. Jennifer Cation Armstrong has written a new history of the show. She spoke with several of the women, who were some of the first to break into the industry, about how the show made it to the air and how it's still influencing the female characters populating your DVR. The book is called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted. Jennifer Cation Armstrong joined us from our New York bureau, and I asked her how the creators of the Mary Tyler Moore Show intended Mary to be different than the other women on TV at the time.
Originally, they had intended for her to be divorced because they felt like that was something that everybody was sort of going through and talking about at that time. They did not get the divorced part through with CBS, but they did manage to have her be single and working.
Which was a big deal.
Very big deal at the time.
I would like to know why the last associate producer before me made $50 a week more than I do.
Oh, because he was a man.
The creators and the producers, James L. Brooks and Alan Burns, they knew their limitations as writers for this show, at least how you write about them, and they knew they wanted women to work on this show. What were they looking for?
They wanted some more insight into what it was like to be a single woman in 1970, because they were both married men. So they brought in a lot of talented female writers, more than most shows had ever done before. So this was very different in the sense that the first person they hired to write for the show was named Treva Silverman, and they loved her work. She became a really intrinsic part of the development of the show and how the show took shape over the first several seasons. And they hired several more women as well. When they first started the show, the women's movement was just kind of like a vague blip in the background, and then it became really this huge thing as time went on.
You write a couple of really compelling vignettes about what it was like to be a woman in television at that time on the production side. One particular television executive, back in the day, she was working in an environment in an office building where they actually didn't have a female restroom on the executive floor.
Yes. One of the early and lone champions of the show at CBS was Ethel Winant. She was the only woman in the sort of executive ranks. And so there was an executive bathroom, but there was only one. And of course, we only need one. It's just for men. So she would leave her high heels outside the door so that men knew she was in there, because there's no lock on the door either, of course.
We talk about Mary Tyler Moore Show breaking a lot of ground, and it did. But
the characters were still operating in a certain moral framework that was illustrative of the time, right? And what got me in going back and watching some episodes was the fact that Mary's signature gag is this outburst of hysterical crying, which is not exactly a feminist message.
I don't want to go to jail! I'm afraid to go to jail! I've never been to jail, Mr. Grant! I never even had to stay after school!
You know, there are a lot of things that are not a feminist message about Mary Richards, and that's part of why she was so effective. Things changed a lot very quickly right after that, right? We got All in the Family, we got Maude, we got a lot of different stuff happening in TV right after that. But this is still 1969, and she also had the Mr. Grant thing. She called Lou Mr. Grant, where everyone else on the show called him Lou.
Mr. Grant?
Oh, Lord.
Mr. Grant?
Did anyone you talked to explain why she did that? Why they wanted her to call him Mr. Grant?
They said they felt like that's what she would do. She's just that kind of person. They really were trying to make her what they call likable on television.
Mr. Grant!
They were really protective of this character early on, and I think that's because it came from that old idea of, you know, making her as good as possible. So that later, when she said she was on the pill or when she stayed out all night, America had already sort of fallen in love with her as this good, decent girl.
You mentioned All in the Family, which debuted just a few months after the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which is a different show. I mean, that show took on really complicated social issues of the time in new ways for television. Racism, homosexuality, even abortion and rape. I mean, they put it all out there. How did that affect the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
I mean, I think there was competition, for sure. They're on the same network. They're on the same night. All in the Family did better in the ratings, made a bigger splash. But the people at the Mary Tyler Moore Show had to kind of go, okay, you know what? We're a different show, and we need to focus on what we do and not try to chase this other thing that's happening in television. And they realized that their whole deal was to just be really character-driven. And if that meant at times Lou gets a divorce, so be it. But that had to come from the character, and they had to do it in a really realistic way. They ended up doing a lot of things like that.
Phyllis, Ben and I aren't getting married.
They had an episode with a gay character where Phyllis's brother turns out to be gay.
He is witty. He is attractive. He's successful. He's single. He's gay.
They only did that, though, when they felt like it was the right thing for all of the characters and that it would feel right.
So the Mary Tyler Moore Show runs for six incredibly successful seasons. The seventh season rolls around, and there's a big conversation about how to end the show. And this is complicated because, as you mentioned, Mary's love life has not been the focal point of the entire series. But it's there, lingering at the edges. Can you talk a little bit about the debate over whether or not to marry Mary off?
They tried several times. There were dating episodes, and a couple guys lasted more than one episode. Very few, but a couple. And they just felt like they never found the right man. I thought that that was such a funny, I mean, they said it that way, and I was like, that's so interesting, right? Because, gosh, I'm sure Mary Richards herself felt that way too, right? Like, I keep trying to cast this guy, and it's just not happening. No, and they really felt like, I mean, it's sort of touching. They were like, no one was good enough for her.
Huh. Where do we see the Mary Tyler Moore Show today? Where do we see it echoed?
I think we see it all over the place. It was part of why I wrote the book, is that I was a writer at Entertainment Weekly for 10 years and did a lot of women in entertainment stuff, and especially the rise of Tina Fey. And when I talked to these women, they all cited the show as their inspiration, which I thought was so interesting that it was still having this echo effect. And now we've had this incredible spate of shows about single girls, lots of them very good. But yeah, you know, I think a lot of the young women who are now creating shows are affected by the show. And of course, I mean, 30 Rock was blatantly sort of patterned as this bizarro version of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I mean, Tina Fey has actually talked about that. And, you know, combining the pathos and the funny is really a hallmark of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. So I think it's all over the place.
The book is called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted. It is written by Jennifer Cation Armstrong. She joined us from our studios in New York. Jennifer, it has been such a fun trip down memory lane with you.
Thank you so much.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well,
I hate spunk.
Girl, this time you're all alone, but it's time you started living. It's time you let someone else do some giving. Love's all around, no need to waste it. You can have it down, why don't you take it? You might just make it after all. You might just make it after all.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. 10 years ago, writer Richard Rubin set out to talk to every living American veteran of World War I he could find. It wasn't easy, but he tracked down dozens of centenarian vets, ages 101 to 113, and collected their stories.
I went to Green Bay and enlisted in the Army. And the big war was on then. I says, I'd like to get into outfit that's going to get over to France quick. You pick out the place where you want me to go. Wherever I could be used, that's where I want to go.
That's veteran Arthur Fiala of Kewaunee, Wisconsin. His story and many more are included in Richard Rubin's new book. It's titled The Last of the Doughboys. And Richard Rubin joins me now to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
All right, thank you for having me.
You know, when you set out on this project, you discovered that it was really hard to get an accounting of who were the living World War I veterans at the time. The VA didn't have a list, VFW, American Legion. But ultimately, it turned out the French knew. And that was your big in.
It was. In 1998, the government of France had started awarding the Legion of Honor, their highest decoration, to living American veterans who'd served in World War I on French soil. They undertook an intensive search for such men, and they ended up finding 550 or so men and women. And eventually I found a list of these people, and that was the first big break I got. I actually found Mr. Fiala and a lot of other people off that list.
Let's go back to Arthur Fiala. He was 104 years old when you talked to him, and we heard him earlier talking about enlisting. He served with the 20th Engineers, shipped out for France early in 1918. And I want to play a little bit more of your interview with him describing that voyage.
4 days, I thought I was in heaven. Oh, it was so nice. The sea was quiet. I was watching the poor boys fly on there diving alongside the boat. And about the fourth day, we got the bluff. I got sick. I was sick.
And Richard Rubin, here's what's so amazing about Arthur Fiala to me, that he remembers so clearly these really tiny details, like those porpoises diving alongside the boat that he mentions. He tells you about a Frenchman that he saw when he lands in France, taking a pee, as he describes it, and at the same time tipping his hat to a woman walking by, clear as a bell in his mind.
Well, that's the kind of thing I don't think you ever forget, I suppose, if you see it, especially if you've just landed in country after a long ocean voyage. But he, at one point we're talking, and he starts to tell me this wonderful story about stumbling into a mountain village in France, and the girls are wearing wooden shoes and carrying a yoke with milk pails, and he's invited into a house, and they keep a cow in the house on the other side of a partition from the living room. And you know, a lot of people that I interviewed had really remarkable memories, but I think his was even special in that group.
Did you find that these veterans, these World War I vets, had told these stories many times before, or were they just excavating things they hadn't talked about or maybe thought about for a really long time?
Quite a few of them told me that they were telling me things that they hadn't talked about in 50, 60, 70 years. I asked a few of them, why not? And the surprising response often was that nobody had asked.
It must have felt like a real race against time to find these centenarians before, you know, it was just too late.
You know, it was. And I'm sorry to tell you that often that was a race that I lost. For everybody who's in this book, there's somebody I didn't get to on time. I remember one gentleman who lived out in Las Vegas. I spoke to his niece, who was his closest living relative. He was 108 at the time. And she said, oh, yes, he's very clear-minded and he loves to talk. So I booked a ticket for 2 weeks hence. And by the time I got out there, he was unconscious in a hospital bed, and he died the next morning.
Mm. You also have some pretty poignant descriptions from these veterans of the moment on November 11th, 1918, when the guns fell silent, when the war was over. One of the veterans you talked to about that moment is George Bryant, and he described it this way. He said, "You looked like you were in a new land. You couldn't believe that everything is quiet."
Yes, and he was, of all the veterans I interviewed, he came the closest to being killed. On July 28, 1918, he and his battery were moving through an open field and they were stopped. And all of a sudden, German planes appeared overhead and dropped bombs on them. And I asked him how many were dropped, and he said he didn't know, but he was hit by every one. And he went to the hospital for several months and had to beg them to send him back to the front. And he got there just a few weeks before the war ended and witnessed horrible, horrible things on the last night of the war.
And when he talked to you about that, he got very, very upset. It must have been a really uncomfortable position for you as the interviewer there.
Well, it was a strange thing. He started crying quite vigorously, but then a couple of minutes later, he stopped just as suddenly, and his mood was actually the best it had been the whole time I was there. And I like to think that maybe he'd purged something that he'd been carrying around for nearly 100 years.
What was he describing that got him so upset?
On the last night of the war, he was walking around and there were some men who had sought shelter in a patch of woods, and the Germans targeted it with artillery, and a number of these men were killed at that spot. And he came upon their bodies very shortly after that happened. And he said, such fine, handsome, healthy young men to be killed on the last night of the war. He said, I cried for their parents. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing to lose anyone you love in a war. But imagine knowing precisely when that war ends and then knowing that your loved one died just hours before that moment.
Hmm. Richard Rubin, World War I was called the Great War. It was supposed to be the war to end all wars. But you say it very quickly became the forgotten war. How do you account for the fact that it's now largely forgotten, became forgotten so quickly?
You know, that's a very interesting question because once upon a time, that was not so. If you walk around with your eyes open, you'll quickly discover that there are more monuments and memorials in this country to World War I than to any other war. But the war was also a terribly traumatic experience for this country. You have to remember that Americans were in that war for only about 19 months, and yet in that time, we lost 117,000 men. It was a terribly traumatic experience, and afterwards, America withdrew into itself. And then, of course, the Great Depression came along and World War II, and the Great War got pushed further back in our national consciousness.
Over there, over there.
Richard Rubin, his book is The Last of the Doughboys, The Forgotten Generation and Their Forgotten World War. Richard Rubin, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
All the World War I veterans whom Richard Rubin talked to for his book, in fact, all the veterans of that war, have now died. The last American veteran in 2011.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.